Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read.
What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast.
This is your host, Guy Swan. I did not get an episode out yesterday, which I'm not 100% sure if I said that I wasn't going to be able to get one on Thursday, but I had hoped maybe I would actually figure out how to record while I was in New York for the Magical Crypto Conference and Pierre Richard's Lightning Workshop or Programming Lightning Workshop, which were both an absolute blast. If you follow me on Twitter, you probably saw a lot of the posts that I had. I got to talk with Aaron Von Wertham and Eric Lombroso, Jeremy Welsh. Crypto Graffiti, like so many people, and I had an absolute blast. It was really a wonderful weekend. But I didn't even get back into North Carolina until late last night. I think I got home around, 9 o'clock, somewhere around there, 10 o'clock. So, there was definitely not going to be an episode yesterday unless I managed to scrounge something up while I was in New York. But today, to start off our week and get right back into the flow of things, I have got a cool little discussion because it's written by Darren Klein, and it's on the page thenewpaper.io, and I've been hitting this one ever since I bumped into this one in February. But this is a cool little, there's a lot of really fun little just kind of thinking about like what Bitcoin does and crypto in general that are just fun little thought experiments. And this one was just a cool little discussion about debt, how we've treated it in the past and what Bitcoin can do to change that, like how Bitcoin changes the fundamental game of how we treat debt in society. And it's called The Ancient Sin of Debt: How Bitcoin Could Make Amends. And I thought this would be a really fun one. I've gone back and forth all over with kind of my plan for what to tackle this week. And there's been a couple of really great things, basically a ton of stuff that happened over the weekend and yesterday, all really have thrown everything up in the air. So now I don't even know what I'm going to do for the rest of this week. I'm trying to get together, get permission to read a number of different articles and topics right now, and I think I want to jump into a guy's take about some of the major things that were announced in the last couple of days with like Bakkt and Microsoft's identity blockchain platform, whatever the hell that is. I think they're calling it Ion. The fact that Casa is involved in this. There's so much to tackle now, and I am really just finally starting to get to, I'm just caught up with a bunch of the stuff that I needed to do in like normal life, and now I'm back to Bitcoin and crypto. So I'm going to dig in and start learning as much as I can, and I want to do an episode about some of those things this week. So stay tuned on that. Don't forget to subscribe. But for now, let's go ahead and jump right into this article, and then we'll have a little bit of discussion to start our week off. And again, this is written by Darren Klein. What is his Twitter tag? I got a message with him. We've been chatting back and forth. Okay, it's @_dkleine. That's DKLEINE. And I would definitely recommend following him and checking out thenewpaper.io because there's a lot of really fun stuff. One that I'm about to read soon is Bitcoin Escaping Fiat Relativity. Sounds like a really fun discussion. So I want to jump into that one too at some point. But right now, let's go ahead and start reading The Ancient Sin of Debt: How Bitcoin Could Make Amends, published on February 11th, 2019. There was a time, many years ago, that the Catholic Church, the religious institution that in many ways inspired the culture of what has become known as the Western world, spoke out strongly against what was known at the time as usury, the charging of interest on loans for the purpose of profit. Over time, the definition and therefore the, quote, sin of usury has changed somewhat. Before being broadly accepted, the simple act of charging interest on lent money was considered inherently sinful. taking advantage of the poverty of others for the already wealthy to become even further enriched. In modern times, usury is more strictly considered to be the charging of exorbitant or predatory interest rates designed to further impoverish borrowers and trap them in debt to the benefit of the lender. Islam has also historically been broadly opposed to usury, so the two largest world religions, globally dominant in terms of adherence and cultural influence, have been pretty clear over time about their stance when it comes to the concept of usury. Yet our entire financial system, spread across the globe, is based on this very concept. To be fair, it is this system that enabled the greatest growth in wealth, quality of life, and economic progress in the history of humankind. Yet there is a big problem at its core. We live in a system that is designed to operate with inescapable debt hardwired into its structure. The burden of inescapable indebtedness has multiplied exponentially with the advent of fiat money as the currency of the global monetary system. Take a moment sometime to watch the U.S. national debt clock, link provided, counting up continuously with no end in sight. It's a frighteningly massive, depressing, and somewhat incomprehensible stream of ever-increasing numbers. Some will say the solution to this problem of debt is a matter of tightening purse strings, managing funds more wisely, or taxing more fairly. None of these solutions will ultimately work, however, because the entire modern system of fiat money is predicated on debt existing and never being fully, quote, paid back. For a brilliant yet succinct explanation of the inception of money as a tool for the creation of indebtedness on a grand scale, Yassine Elmandra created a series of tweets, link, that simply should not be missed. At the heart of it, the message is clear. Money, as it is created today, is made out of thin air, bought in exchange for indebtedness to private parties, who then charge interest for its repayment. There is a pretty significant problem with this arrangement that nobody ever seems to think about. If the money is created out of debt and can only be paid back with more money created out of debt, how can the debt ever really be paid in full? Short answer, it can't. Thus, the modern system of monetary creation via debt is doomed for failure. It could take years, decades, even centuries, but it is at some point unsustainable. It is into this broken system that cryptocurrency enters as a potential tool by which one can make amends for the sin of usury. Bitcoin, among many other cryptocurrencies, is not made from debt. It is a result of work. Granted, money must be spent in order to acquire the necessary equipment for the mining and generation of the currency. However, since the currency itself is not issued out of debt, no private entity, like the Federal Reserve, for example, stands to gain from charging interest on money that would otherwise be made out of thin air. Instead, the money is awarded to those who produce the work in the form of enormous calculations working to solve mathematical puzzles to achieve consensus through a method called proof of work, a mechanism that is necessary for its creation. Perhaps this is why, some time ago, it was determined that Bitcoin is compliant with Sharia law. In fact, one could argue that the creation of money via tools like proof-of-work consensus is far more compliant with principles of monetary justice, principles that go beyond the confines of any particular religion, than the current monetary system, which entirely depends on the indebtedness of all users, save for the few original issuers of the money and their closest friends and allies. That's not to say that proof-of-work currencies are the only manner by which cryptocurrencies might disrupt the modern monetary system. Many forms of consensus that are potentially far more efficient than proof-of-work are in use by cryptocurrency technologies. The key distinction? These currencies offer the possibility of a different kind of money. Money that, upon its issuance, does not immediately cause the user to be indebted to the issuer, but instead allows the user to enter into the financial ecosystem with a capacity to freely participate without debt. Perhaps the time is coming that the world can make amends for the egregious sins of debt and usury. Reflecting on these principles, it becomes clear that cryptocurrencies can indeed cause a paradigm shift in the way the world interacts economically, much to the chagrin of those who currently hold the reins. This newfound technology has the potential to move the global economic system away from indebtedness and usury to a new form of exchange and economic interaction that does not depend on the infinite creation of debt to flourish. All right, that concludes the article. I want to jump into some really fun discussion about this just because the idea of usury as a sin has always been very interesting to me. That's one of the things that really kind of took me down the economics rabbit hole years before I even found Bitcoin, or I guess really before Bitcoin even existed at the time. And so I think this is just a really interesting topic that I haven't seen addressed specifically, I don't think, or at least haven't come across it in the Bitcoin space. So let's hit some commentary just after we talk about our sponsor and I go get another coffee. All right, so just to refresh, that was called The Ancient Sin of Debt and How Bitcoin Could Make Amends. And it was by Darren Klein, and you can find this with a ton of other articles on thenewpaper.io. All right, so as I was talking about, like, the idea of usury and the fact that it used to be, or that the dominant religions have considered it jointly a sin, like when I was first diving into economics and kind of exploring all these ideas, that was very interesting to me. And before you really have like a strong idea of what money is in your head, it kind of like on the surface, you kind of have to like almost agree with it from a stance of like what does it mean? And but is it like when you think about what money is doing in a society, is usury actually a sin? And if not, why would they think that it was? Like, where does that idea come from? So for a very, very long time, I spent and like I read, my brother and I debated. He was an economics major, so we would constantly talk about this stuff. And it's an extremely long journey to trying to piece together what money really is at its core and what it is enabling for a society to do. And what money really is, what it means to have a lot of money, it's a way to store and allocate past value creation and exchange. This is with a money that is natural, a money that is actually sound. This does not apply to today's money on its face. It may be the case most of the time, but the nature of money, like how the money is designed and how it is issued into creation, has 100% say over whether or not that's what money is doing. But if when we're talking about sound money and a natural money in an economy that just is adopted because it's a useful money, then what it means to have money, what the role that it is doing is storing and allocating value that you have created in the past and actually exchange with someone. You've made the resources or the actual value available to someone else. You've taken the money instead, and you have yet to consume that same value out of the economy. So you've put value in, and you have yet to take it out. You're holding it in money because money will not lose its value, if it's a good money, of course, will not lose that value over time. It's a way to store it for today, so that I can use it in a year. And because if I store it in anything else, if I store it in, chickens, it's going to rot. If I store it in, cooked chickens, it's going to rot. If I store it in actual chickens, well, then I have this huge maintenance cost to feed them. If I store it in any other asset, obviously it's going to deteriorate or it's going to lose its value just in the fact that it's aged over that period of time, et cetera, et cetera. That's what makes a good money different from the other goods it's exchanged for. That is one of the key characteristics, is that in 2 years, the money is identical to the money that it was 2 years ago. So the ability to like renting that money out is not inherently evil nor a sin. Like on its face, it's actually, and it doesn't enrich the wealthy at the expense of the poor. But it's easy to see, like what you're actually doing is, like when you're lending money, is it's no different from lending any resource for a fee. It could just as easily be a car or a renting out a space, like a workspace or a living space from a building. Would you consider that evil to, like, if you own your car and, you know, usually you want to take it to and from work or to the places that you want to go and back? Like, if you rent it out, obviously you're going to need to charge somebody for that. You've just lost your car. Like, obviously, it's not evil to rent out your car to somebody because you no longer have your car. You no longer get the value from that. If you're renting out your money, you're just not specifying what type of resource they're going to be using. Money is just the quote unquote anything resource, but it's no different when you rent your money for an interest rate. You're just allowing them access to what could just as easily be a car or a space to live or work. It's not really any different except for the fact that you haven't specified it's one specific resource versus another, because money can be exchanged for almost any resource. That's what makes money money. So when you just kind of look at it on its face, it's obviously not evil or a sin. So it's like, how did people come to think of it like that? Like what happened? So you can easily begin to see how evil it is to lend money that doesn't exist. Like when you realize that that's what money is doing, is allocating value to the people who have created it or produced it in the past, you begin to start to see the seed of how unbelievably terrible it is to lend money, to issue money into existence as a loan. So in any real sense, when we're talking about real resources in the economy, if I want to loan you a car, I have to have a car. Like I can't just create car tokens and have you go rent someone else's car, because where how did I get a car to how did I how do I have the right to give you a car that I don't have? Like I have to actually own the resources to be able to lend it to you. And since money is the ultimate resource, is the ultimate good for, in the sense that it can be exchanged for any resource in the economy, it becomes to be obvious, like you start to see what it means to loan money into existence. So to work this out in our heads, let's have a little thought experiment in an economy that has three people. We've got you, we've got me, and then we've got Jamie Dimon. And you are the one that has produced all the resources. Whatever those resources are, let's say it's a place to live, you've gone and collected and found water or food or any of those things, and you have created all of this into the economy, and now you have those resources to loan out. I should only be able to get what I want to do is I now want to use those resources. I want to consume that food so that I can build some project or whatever where I can produce value. Maybe I'm producing sandwiches, or I'm going to build a house or something like that. I want to add value to the economy as well. I just don't have any capital resources to do so. You have all the capital resources because you're the one that produced it all. So I need to borrow it from you in order to make use of those saved resources. Now we've got Jamie Dimon, and he has the special government monetary privilege of simply inventing money, just issuing it into existence. And then you unknowingly accept this money, thinking that it's real money, not realizing that it's just Jamie Dimon's privilege that we're trading around. So he's going to loan me the money to get those resources from you. Now, I owe that money back to Jamie at interest. I don't owe those resources back to you. I owe them to Jamie Dimon. He did not make any new resources. Like, what is available to buy is still only the goods that you made and now all those goods are gone. You have nothing to eat. When I purchase those goods, I am removing the surplus that you created, consuming them for my benefit, and Jamie is the one making all of the money back. He is the one that I have to now pay back my productive value. If I'm building a house or sandwiches or whatever, I have to give those back to Jamie because Jamie loaned all of your resources to me, even though he had no control over them. And now the prices, using that money as the metric, the prices of all those resources have skyrocketed because now you're competing with me and Jamie over actually consuming them when you're the one that produced them. They're your resources. You're having to buy them back at a higher price. So we have this tiny little economy where prices are just skyrocketing. Nobody understands why the person, you in this case, cannot get the value back that they just created. And after years and years of this, we have funneled all of our productive value, anything that I have created from this loan and anything that you have created to try to get your value back has all been funneled to Diamond with first the entire initial loan plus some like 80%, maybe even 100% additional from the interest he charged me, again, on resources that weren't his. So he has gotten disgustingly wealthy with nothing other than the ability to manipulate the money, while both of the producers in the economy have gotten poor. So the desire, this is the ultimate power of an economy, because economic production is the means to all of our ends. There's nothing we can do, like nothing that we hope or dream about accomplishing in life that does not involve production or creating value, consuming value in some way. And we have to do that from someone else. Like if our dream is to make a movie, our dream is to have a house and a stable life, whatever it is, we can't do it without trading with other people in the economy. So the ability to manipulate money, like that power is the ultimate power. It's the power to control what everyone has to do to reach the ends, the means to everyone's ends. And this is not the desire to manipulate this is not something that was just recently invented. It's not like fiat money is the first time that this has been unbelievably corrupted. Like since money was invented, it has been manipulated and corrupted. It's the nature of something that is so unbelievably desirable. So it makes perfect sense that this is something that would have been occurring for thousands of years. Even if we don't have enough data on specific cases of this, or whether this is on a huge scale like the Roman Empire, or a small scale like some specific institution, or maybe even just a small village and what they considered money, it's obvious that this is going to be something that is just prevalent throughout the history of money, and it's something that causes instability and impoverishes people who are producing at the benefit of those who have used the corruption, have manipulated the money, the asset that is used as money, essentially giving all the wealth to people who did not deserve it and enriching them at the cost of everyone who is basically working their butts off to keep society running. So it's a very common thing for people to jump on either hating or banning or blaming something that's related to or near the source of the problem, but still not understanding exactly where the source is, like what the true problem is. We are naturally very, very ignorant beings. Like humans always get this wrong. We've universally like made this mistake millions of times in history where we ban a thing that may include the thing that is causing our problem, but A is 80% completely innocent or sensible. So that's how I think usury became its thing. Because when you think about it, if usury gets lumped into the, if people have no solid understanding of what money is, which arguably for the first thousands of years, it was just a thing that was and nobody understood it. Like most of the science of economics and theories on money have been, in the last 200-300 years, really. So if if somebody saw the manipulation of money and the unbelievable corruption and unfairness from that position, it makes perfect sense they would essentially throw the baby out with the bathwater. That rather than actually understanding the very subtle and difficult to understand concept of what money is and the difference between like an honest loan and manipulating money, like issuing it as a debt that is not backed by anything. Obviously, that is difficult to do now for an educated modern individual. Most people don't get it. That's infinitely harder for a population 1,000, 2,000 years ago, where 99.9% of people just can't even read. So they simply ban the idea of earning interest on a loan, period, which does in fact solve the problem, despite the enormous unnecessary cost attached to it by preventing all capital from reaching the people who need it and actually properly pricing the risk of someone else making use of it, because that's what an interest rate is. It's a combination of two things. It's the price of the time for someone else to make use of resources. Like person, like in your case, or in our case, you are the person who has created all of these resources, and I'm the person who wants to make use of them. And maybe you don't have an immediate use, so it doesn't make sense for you to hold on to them and not gain any value from it. Because if you give it to me and you can trust me, or you take the risk on me and, you know, providing a house, which is going to be worth twice what the resources I put into it are, or I've got some machine that I want to make that produces shirts, you know, like taking that risk could earn you a significant profit and myself a significant profit by allowing me to use those resources. And so that's the price of time. You've given up the ability to use your resources today in exchange for giving it to me in hopes that I could be even more productive with it. And so that's the first thing that the interest rate is doing, is it's pricing the time cost of not using resources today that you own, but instead giving it to me for me to use it. And then the other price is the risk of the individual being loaned to. If I have never paid off a loan, then obviously the risk of giving it to me is very high. I might just squander all of those resources. I might just consume everything you produced and have absolutely nothing to show for it. The interest rate should absolutely price that in. I should not get a good interest rate if I'm a completely worthless individual, or maybe even I'm completely honest. You know, maybe I have all the best intentions. Maybe I'm a good person in every other way, but maybe I'm an incredibly hard worker. But if I don't know the first thing about really producing value and how to be like incredibly productive versus just wasting my time on some very trivial or low value task, then it still should not be given to me, even if I'm poor. Like, someone else is going to make the society more valuable, is going to make the society more productive, which will actually benefit me, than giving the money directly to me. And I might end up in a worse spot because now I've got a loan to pay back that I never knew how to produce for in the first place. Like, what's a good example of something like this? Like, let's say I'm an honest person and I want to, we've got a small town that needs water, and I work my butt off. And what I do is I carry buckets of water. There's a well or a river or something that's, 2 miles away. And what I do is I carry buckets of water from the river all the way into this town every single day, and I charge for it. Like, if someone gave me a loan, I'm only going to be able to make as much, even if I work all day, every day. I work 18 hours a day carrying buckets of water back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I'm still going to be a high-risk investment because I'm not doing anything that someone else couldn't do. Now imagine there's another guy who decides he wants to take out this loan and build a pipeline from the river to the city. And for the first whole year of this project, he's not going to bring any water in. But as soon as that pipeline is done, in 2 days, he is going to move more water than I did in the whole previous year combined into the town. and he's going to be able to do it at a price that I could never manage. Now, giving the money to me, despite the fact that I may be honest, I may be an incredibly hard worker, is not the best use of that money. Because I am going to, the only way for me to provide water for the whole town is if I get like 20 other people together and we just move buckets constantly. Whereas the other guy's going to build a pipeline, and then after that pipeline is built, nobody has to run it. It's just, all we have to do is maintain it a little bit to keep it running. And suddenly the entire town has essentially an endless supply of water, and at a price that I could never pull off. It's vastly more beneficial to the town or to our little society than giving it to me, even if I may have been the harder worker. He was the smarter worker. So in that sense, it doesn't matter who is poor or who is wealthy. It's got to do with who is going to make better uses of those resources. Because I am, as nice as a guy as I am and as a hard worker as I am, if I'm just carrying buckets of water to get water to the town, I'm going to be a far, far greater risk in loaning money to than the guy who's got this brilliant idea to build this pipeline. Of course, his pipeline might not work, but if it does work, it's going to be 100 times more capable and efficient than my entire system. And after we do that work, it's now capital that we can trade. It's capital that's going to exist almost indefinitely. Like, we just have a small maintenance cost. Whereas mine, as soon as I empty the buckets, we got to do the whole process over again. Like, every single day, I have made no improvement over exactly how I am getting water from point A to point B. So that's why I think usury itself is not a bad thing. The idea of charging interest is actually critical to the idea of just loaning out resources to people who do not own it. I think it's completely, it's inevitable. You can't have resource allocation without some degree of debt and loaning. And the interest rate is a critical price to determine what it means to spend value today as opposed to later on. So how does Bitcoin change this? What's different in our economy today versus a Bitcoin economy is Bitcoin is eliminating the Jamie Dimons of the world. That third person who soaked up all the resources and made it so that he was the one using those resources, even though you had produced it all and I was the one that needed it, it eliminates his position from the economy because the money itself can no longer be manipulated. He can't issue an asset. He can say it's Bitcoin, but he can't actually issue Bitcoin outside of the rules. He has to play within that system. He has to compete. He cannot get the political privilege. He cannot get the authority to make it any greater, with any greater degree of efficiency, or there's no special privilege to his ability to issue currency against anyone else's. So it immediately becomes a market, and it's a market that races towards zero. It's a higher cost, and the margin gets tighter and tighter and tighter as more people are actually mining to create Bitcoin. So, and this is exactly why anybody who saw the Representative Sherman's thing about how all crypto should be banned because it's threatening the dollar and it makes sanctions not viable and all of this stuff, it rightfully scares the crap out of those people. Because they do not exist in that world. In a world with Bitcoin, none of their authority or position means anything. He knows, he's well aware that their power is derived. And it's fascinating to me how explicit and just completely open, just like flippant he was about the fact that he's dictating the movement of capital, their political position to just decide where capital moves in the world, which is essentially making people slaves without telling them. That in a world with cryptocurrency, in a world where they do not have the monopoly over the issuance of money, they can't play that game. They can't make people slaves. They can't trap people into this rat race of prices that never seem to stop going up, that minimum wage always, we have to beg the political sphere to increase the minimum wage because yet again, 2 years down the road, it's worth jack all. That healthcare is so unaffordable, it's laughable. That higher education has now become one of the absolute worst investments you could ever make as a young adult. We are all stuck in this race chasing our tails while the financial system is just getting soaking up so many resources from the economy that the Federal Reserve is more powerful than it's ever been. And while everybody else, everybody who's producing and keeping society together, producing the food and the houses and the skills and doing all the learning and actual value production, can't seem to make any forward progress because prices and costs are constantly outpacing our ability to pay back the loans to actually make the production happen. And that's exactly what Darren Klein is talking about in this article, is that the only way we can pay back the debt, the way the math actually works, because new money is debt. Every new dollar is issued as a debt, backed by another piece of debt somewhere else. And the fact that we have interest on this newly issued money, it is genuinely impossible to pay it back. As soon as you start paying it back, the money actually vanishes from the economy because it is the loan that backs the existence of the money. So we're not only chasing just our default, like we're not only chasing zero, we're having this 10 to 20% overhead of an interest cost to institutions that aren't producing in this cycle. They're just this third party that's soaking up all of the extra that we can ever manage to squeeze out from working and producing with our entire lives. Like our entire lives are becoming dedicated to their vision of the world instead of our own. And it's a horrible, terrible, sinful thing. And Bitcoin actually changes the fundamental nature of how money works. It makes this privilege and this authority to manipulate and corrupt money impossible again. It turns money back into a natural resource and no longer an authoritative resource. So these parasites that do not produce, that are not required to produce anything of value into the economy in order to soak all of this value out, in order to allocate all these resources towards their goals or their ends, that will no longer be possible. Obviously, it will still happen to some degree, but it cannot be possible within the Bitcoin network. The asset of Bitcoin is not subject to this type of manipulation due to its mathematical properties. That proof of work means that they have to produce something of value. In the case of Bitcoin being an additional security, that's what that proof of work does, is it creates irreversibility to any transactions that have happened on the Bitcoin system. That your ownership, that Jamie Dimon's ability to issue new Bitcoin is directly related to how much work he produces to secure your ownership rather than cheat it, which is what we have in our current situation. He has the privilege to cheat your ownership. Proof of work means that they have to prove that they've secured your ownership in order to get the newly issued Bitcoin. It's a completely, it flips the whole thing on its head and turns it around to you have to produce, you have to give work in order to ensure others' ownership and ensure others' sovereignty in order to get the issuance of new coins into existence. And that is a fundamental, that is a massive disruptor, and it completely changes the architecture of money and the financial system on a completely global level. Not to mention that it has no borders, that it doesn't care about which jurisdiction it's in, that the rules are completely independent of government enforcement. They are cryptographically enforced. If you can maintain security over your keys entirely under your responsibility, no one can challenge it. There is no Jamie Dimon. There is no Federal Reserve. There is no government that can just say your keys no longer unlock your coins. Bitcoin doesn't care. It is independent ownership through and through, regardless of government enforcement. It would be nice for them to enforce it because obviously everything would work smoother that way, but you don't need to. You do not have to rely on government to enforce your ownership. You can do it cryptographically by securing your own keys. And that is a brilliant and fascinating shift to how economic, to how society allocates all resources. And that's why I think Bitcoin, who cares its transaction capacity? Bitcoin is a $10 to $20 trillion asset, hands down. And that may actually be underestimating what it could actually produce for the world, like how it could actually change the nature of value creation, the nature of who owns what they actually produced, and end such a huge portion of financial manipulation and monetary corruption that I can't see of anything else that could make the impact that Bitcoin could when we're talking about global adoption. So I just really enjoyed this piece by Darren Klein. I've always loved this discussion. It's something that I love to think about and continue to re-hit this topic as many times as possible. And I had never, this is the first time I really took a dive down the newpaper.io. And it looks like there's a lot of fun stuff. And Darren's got a lot of other things that he has written on this topic and more, and about Bitcoin in general. So I definitely encourage you to go, you guys to go over there. Don't forget to follow Darren Klein. That's _DKLEINE on Twitter. Obviously, I will tag him in the post and link to the actual article and the newpaper.io. Don't forget to check him out and check out that page for I'm sure a ton of new and fun stuff to come in the future. And with that, don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy. We got a lot of fun stuff coming out this week. We are back in action. Thank you guys for sticking with me over the long weekend. I kind of want to dedicate an episode to talking about all the cool stuff from the Magical Crypto Conference. Don't forget to check out my recent tweets for all the people I got to meet and have discussions with. And yeah, we will close this one here. Thanks again, guys. And don't forget, oh yeah, if you would like to support the show, if you are enjoying this, if you enjoyed this discussion, if you love being able to listen to all of these awesome articles, it takes up a ton of my time. And anything that you can do, there's two things actually you could do. I do make a little bit of money from the sponsors of this show. So just sharing it out with other people in the Bitcoin and crypto space is a huge help. And thank you to everyone who does that. And then obviously you can also donate to the show. I've got a Bitcoin address and a Lightning tip jar on my website at cryptoeconomy.life. Or of course you can just tip, if you've got tipping.me, you can just tip right on the actual tweet of this episode. So if you would like to support the show, don't forget to do that. It is massively, massively appreciated, and it keeps this thing running. So thank you guys so much. I will catch you all tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Guy, the Crypto Economy Podcast. This is Guy Swan. I am signing off. Until tomorrow, take it easy, guys.